Good morning, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Let's crank up the climate cast.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
New at 5:30, jobs in the solar industry jumped up 25% in 2016 and now employ more than 370,000 workers. That's according to the U.S. Department of Energy's latest report.
Don't look now, but renewable energy is booming. Solar jobs, they're among the fastest growing job sector in the nation. They grew at 25% last year. In fact, one in 50 new jobs created last year in the U.S. were in solar. And it's not just solar. The fastest growing job category in the U.S. last year, wind turbine technician, according to Business Insider. As many as 4 million workers are now employed in the so-called clean energy and sustainability sector. Today on ClimateCast, the clean energy revolution. Can we engineer our way to a climate change solution, create millions of jobs, and build the U.S. economy in the process? I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. We're going to devote the whole hour today to climate solutions and jobs. We've got some great guests to break this down. Chris Farrell is NPR News Chief Economics Correspondent. We've got the A-team in here today. Hi, Chris.
How are you doing?
Good morning. And Heidi Garrett Pelletier is an Assistant Research Professor in the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And she actually wrote the book, Creating a Clean Energy Economy, How Investments in Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Can Create Jobs in a Sustainable Economy. Heidi, welcome to ClimateCast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Heidi, I want to start with you. A 25% growth rate in solar jobs last year. What is your take on those numbers from last year?
Well, it's true that the solar energy industry is booming. As you said, the wind industry is booming as well. And, you know, one thing about the both solar and wind industries is that it's all kinds of different industries that are implicated in there. It's construction jobs, manufacturing jobs, and it's a revitalization of various parts of the economy. So it's really a path toward job creation in a lot of different areas.
And are most of those jobs U.S.-based?
They are. I mean, there's certainly a booming clean energy industry in other countries as well. But even if we are importing solar panels or importing wind turbines, there's still all of the construction and maintenance and the technicians that are required here in the U.S. But it is true that manufacturing in the U.S. is picking up in solar and wind.
Chris, solar, it's said, growing at 12 times the rate of the economy overall. How much of a success story are the solar and renewable energy sectors in our economy?
I think it's an enormous success story. And one of the surprises is how fast the price of solar has gone down.
Yes.
And because I was at presentations, you've been at presentations a couple of years ago, and they had kind of a curve going down as there would be technological advances. But this has happened much more rapidly. And the same thing. Now, my sense with solar, been a number of presentations where everyone's just going, look at the price. This has changed the dynamics.
And it's like, what, 70% drop in the last
yes.
5 or 8 years.
So
right?
this is a rapid technological change, and it's just changing the fundamental economics of the business. Mm-hmm. Wind, my sense is, has been more quiet. And yet now we're starting to realize that with wind, all of a sudden the economics of wind, the turbines are getting better. We understand more how to construct them. You're getting more money coming into it. I mean, it's interesting to look at the offshore wind. I mean, this is for Europe, mm-hmm. but the offshore wind, Goldman Sachs and LEGO are investing in offshore
wow.
wind. So you're getting some really interesting investing groups coming into this market.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a presentation of Green River Energy, which is an energy co-op in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And now wind is their baseline energy. That is what sort of determines what they're going to be doing. Still very coal dependent, but no
sure.
longer coal driving. It's wind that drives it.
And, you know, it's interesting to note, too, I think that now the number of jobs in solar is something like 2 or 3 times the jobs in coal. And I believe it's matched the natural gas industry last year for the first time.
Yeah.
Heidi, looking at the growth in renewable energy jobs over the past few years, have we just scratched the surface here? How much more potential for growth is still ahead?
Absolutely. We've just scratched the surface. There's a huge potential still. There are, you know, many more solar installations that can go up, whether it's utility field solar or residential solar panels on roofs and such. So there's still a huge demand to be met, and we can meet that domestically. So there's certainly a lot of room for growth in that industry.
We're talking about the clean energy revolution today on ClimateCast here on NPR News. Chris Farrell is my guest, and also Heidi Garrett Pelletier from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. If you have a comment or a question, jump in today. The number to call 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. What do you think about the boom in solar and other renewable energy? And how do you think that this plays out for the future? We want to know if you've had any experience. Do your neighbors have solar? Do you buy wind or solar from your power utility? I'd like to hear your experience as well this morning. Chris, can we isolate what's causing this boom here? How much of it is market forces? How much of it is technology? And how much of it is policy? Is there a way to sort of break that down, or do you have a sense for it?
So my sense for it, and Heidi may have a better sense, my sense is that policy has been very important, but now that we're going through a period where policy is going to be less supportive, it doesn't matter the way that it would have 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. That this is now being driven by the market, and you have utilities around the country. And utilities, by definition, are long-term investors. They do have to have a long-term time horizon.
Sure.
And they're moving more and more and investing more in alternatives. And you know, one of the striking stories is Philip Anschutz, who is the billionaire, owns a big ranch in Wyoming. And there's a lot of wind, and he's going to turn, you know, he wants to build a cable from the wind farm that he wants to create in Wyoming to supply California, because Wyoming's got about 600,000 people. California has about 39 million people.
Right.
And using that energy. So at this point, you're starting to see real money coming into this business. The demand is there. And so this is the direction that we're going. What public policy can do is accelerate the move or slow it down. It's not going to stop it.
Let's take a call. David in Minneapolis has a question about solar. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm 100% behind solar in the right place. I've been thinking about putting it on my house here in Minneapolis, and I cannot get a good answer from any of the solar companies as to how efficient solar is on a really overcast day when it's raining, how efficient it is, you know, how well it works when it's buried under a foot or two of snow. And, you know, battery technology isn't there yet, and it's really dependent upon good, solid batteries that don't have to be replaced all the time. And Gates and a number of companies are out there with nuclear. The latest nuclear technology, from what I've seen online, is some great stuff. It really looks like it's totally safe.
All right, David, good question.
We need that.
We get your points. Good mix of energy is what David is for. And I do know this about solar in Minnesota. It's actually a very good place for solar. We get a lot more sunshine than some of the other places on the coast, and that certainly helps. And actually, solar panels tend to be more efficient when the temperature is colder. But Heidi talks about snow, and I think you're dealing with some snow today out in Amherst, if I'm not mistaken. What's your sense, or what do you read about and hear about for solar in northern climates?
Well, it's surprising. I mean, certainly if they're covered with a foot of snow, as we're in the midst of getting right here, you're not going to get too much solar activity on your panels. But in places even like Seattle, where there's a lot of rain, where it's overcast quite a bit of the time, they still find solar to be efficient. So it doesn't actually have to be a bright, sunny day for solar panels to work. You know, as they're covered with snow, they're not going to generate electricity. But in northern climates, they can work quite well.
Yeah, it's just like your TV satellite dish, I guess. You got to brush it off. Chris, what do you think?
And one of the things his question just reminds me is when we're thinking about job growth, and we're looking down the road, it's about investment and where's the investment going. So, you know, I think a lot of us are excited about, you know, the driverless car, the autonomous car, you know, thinking about Tesla and everyone's getting in that. But this is this going to become the battery? As, you know, as more and more people have them, is this going to become your storage unit? There's experiments going on in northern Minnesota using electric buses and using mm-hmm. them possibly as a storage unit for peak demand. And there is the batteries that's going on in Nevada with Tesla, and there's a lot of money going in there.
Yeah.
So again, this is attracting a lot of brain power and a lot of money, and that's one of the things that's driving this. And why I think we are such at a critical juncture is that the money and the brain power is saying this is the future.
Let's take another, grab another call if we can. Ryan is in St. Paul, has another comment about solar energy. Ryan, good morning. What do you got?
Yeah, thank you. My name's Ryan Biggie. I work at All Energy Solar here in St. Paul, and we've been right in the middle of all this the last few years. I've really been excited to see our company grow as there's been some good commitments from the state. But one thing we're seeing is that a lot of the bedrock policies that have really driven growth in the state are being threatened this year. We have both a state policy that is helping Xcel customers to move forward, which is at risk of being pulled away, mm-hmm. as well as a co-op law that's moving through to eliminate oversight on the PUC. And ultimately, we see that solar growth in Minnesota might slow down here considerably this year if some laws can move through.
Let me ask.
One big thing we're seeing is that the public or the local utilities aren't necessarily properly valuing the benefits for solar as well as the cost to serve those customers.
Okay. Let me just stop you for a second and give our audience a little insight into your company. How big is your company, and how much have you grown in terms of jobs over the last few years?
Yeah, absolutely. We focus on the construction end of things. We're an installation company, mm-hmm. and at this point, we're employing 60 employees in the state of Minnesota. When I joined the company 2 years ago, we had just 15 folks on staff. So in just a matter of 2 years, almost 45 positions have been added in the company, and everything from accounting and HR and entry-level sales positions through to on-site labor, master electricians, and very skilled positions.
All right. Ryan, thank you so much. Heidi, Ryan's experience dealing with state and local governments, how's that playing out across the rest of the nation?
Well, it's hard to say, but what I can say is that state-level policy is going to become increasingly important in this current administration, where we can expect federal policy to become less and less supportive. And so a lot is being done at the state level. There are a lot of states that have renewable portfolio standards where utilities have to have a percentage of their electric generation coming from renewables. There are lots of different incentives for businesses and homeowners at the state level. And so preserving those state level policies is going to be as important as ever in these next 4 years.
Chris, overall, as solar and renewables begin to accelerate, is this sort of boom happening faster than many business analysts thought it might?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I mean, if you think back, you go back to 2005 and that period of time, and you know the advocates, the enthusiasts, they had mm-hmm. these really incredible numbers.
Right.
But the more sober-minded were saying, no, you got to slow down here. And again, I think that they just simply underestimated. And one of the things they underestimated is the demand.
Really?
For this product.
Okay.
So off of what Ryan was saying mm-hmm. and what was Heidi was saying on the state level, so in a place like Arizona, mm-hmm. there have been real battles with the Public Utility Commission about solar. And you've had these unusual political alliances between environmentalists and Tea Party folks who kind of want to be able to have their own solar and panels, and
sure.
they want it to be economic. And the Public Utility Commission has kind of done some inside games to kind of stop that. And this fight is kind of going around the country. So the state level stuff is really important. But I think overall what you're seeing is a shift toward, okay, this is the future. Some of the utilities would love to slow the future down. Other utilities are wanting to speed it up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we're going.
Interesting. Interesting bedfellows. It seems everybody likes solar across different sort of political lines. So Heidi and Chris, I kind of want to tell you about what prompted the idea for this show today. Clearly, I may have been watching too much cable news the last couple of weeks. But Sunday morning, I woke up from this bizarre dream. Some might call it a nightmare. But in the dream, I was assigned to cover President Trump while he was playing golf, of all things. I know, keep dreaming. But somehow we began talking about solar jobs. And I tried to point out to him that the biggest jobs program in history could be a clean energy revolution. He bought it and told me to get together kind of a group of scientists, engineers, and government leaders, business leaders, and create sort of a clean energy jobs task force. Anyway, I woke up back to reality, right? And since that's not going to happen, and the three of us are here today, I wanted to do a little thought experiment. Let's say we have all the power now, and it's our turn to create sort of climate change economic moonshot and a Marshall Plan on a clean energy revolution. What might that look like if we had the resources? Heidi, do you want to start with that and sort of give us some futuristic thinking here?
Sure. I think there are a number of things we can do. First of all, we have an economy that could be much more efficient with its energy. So the first thing would be investing in energy efficiency, so making our buildings more efficient, making industrial process more efficient, making transportation more efficient with electric vehicles and more public transportation and all that. And then we can very feasibly and economically quadruple our renewable energy from where we are today. Quadruple it over the next 20 years in a way that's very feasible. And the institute where I work, the Political Economy Research Institute, we put out a study looking at the U.S. a couple years ago, and for about 1.2% of GDP, which is, you know, not nothing, but certainly an affordable amount, we could bring energy efficiency to a level where we're using 30% less energy, we're quadrupling our renewable energy, we're bringing fossil fuels way down, and we're getting on track to bring our emissions down by 40% over 20 years.
Hmm.
And that's only 1.2% of GDP. So it's definitely doable. And then I would add one more thing to mm-hmm. that is if we think about pricing carbon. So, you know, as we've heard already on the show today, the price of renewables has come way down. Solar, wind, those are really cost competitive now. If we want to make them even more competitive, we can price fossil fuels higher and really account for the damage that they're doing to the atmosphere.
Chris Farrell, the jobs is always the key word for everything, right? Any sense for what the investment and business opportunity would be and how many jobs we might create?
So since you've made me czar for the moment.
You're it.
So I think that economists have had this idea out there, which is really good. So forget the ones at the sort of fringe institutes and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And if people go to the Wall Street Journal the other day, you had Jim Baker and George Shultz, sort of the grand statesmen of the Republican Party, essentially build off of this idea, which is say, look, there's an old adage mm-hmm. in public finance, tax the things you don't like and tax less the things you do like. So have a carbon tax, a big carbon tax. And then you can decide, okay, we're going to cut individual tax rates or we'll cut the corporate tax rates or we'll provide what the Shultz-Baker plan is, a dividend to every family, which would be about $2,000 a year, whatever sort of plan you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But have a carbon tax. Give people a break elsewhere because taxing employment labor less, hey, that's kind of a nice thing.
Sure.
And then let the market work, because then you're going to get every business, every organization is going to be looking around and saying, okay, we need to invest more in our efficiency and our energy. We're not going to decide whether it's going to be electric cars or biomass cars or whatever it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Let the market work. The amount of investment and growth that you would have, and you don't have a bunch of wise people getting together and saying where the investment's going to be. All you simply done is raise the price of carbon.
And let the market decide.
And then let the market decide.
And didn't they just pitch this, Secretary Baker, in the White House, I believe, yesterday or the day before,
correct,
didn't they? It met in the Roosevelt Room.
And you have, and some people are skeptical, but you have Secretary of State Tillerson also came out when he was head of Exxon. They came out in favor of a carbon tax.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most efficient way to go, which probably means we won't go that way, mm-hmm. but it is the most efficient way to go.
All right, let's grab another phone call, get somebody in. How about Nora from St. Paul? Good morning, Nora. How are you doing this morning, and what's your question?
I'm great. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about what it looks like for small, low-population communities after the construction boom ends, particularly thinking about wind because of how disruptive it is to the environment in terms of digging. Are there long-term training possibilities for locals, and are there efforts to contribute to long-term economic development for the small towns after the – or does it kind of with more of a boom and bust kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Heidi, do you have any perspective on that?
I wish I did. It's a really good question. Unfortunately, I don't. Maybe Chris does.
All right, Chris, what do you think?
So I think this is one of the important things. We're talking about job growth and, you know, about the green job growth. And this is exciting. But remember, there are also jobs being destroyed. And that's the nature of our economy. Every day there are jobs being created, jobs being destroyed. And the people who are in, say, the you know, the brown sectors of the economy, right? The old energy sectors of the economy are not necessarily the people that are going to get the jobs, even if it's insulation or construction, in the green sectors of the economy for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. So one of the things when we're talking about the growth in jobs in different sectors of the economy, it doesn't change the fundamental challenges as a society we face. And this election told us that we face is that when you have dynamic change, and this is what this is, a dynamic change in our economy, some people are going to profit from it. Some people are going to lose their jobs. What do you do to help the people out who are going to lose their jobs? Mm-hmm. And this really does bring to the fore that question, again, whether it's international competition, it's technological change, or it's green jobs, people will be left behind. What are you going to do about those people?
Heidi, you mentioned this a little bit ago, and we're going to talk more about this in the next half hour, but sort of changing the balance of power generation to renewables, we've talked about that, but retrofitting America's big buildings and homes for peak energy efficiency, that's potentially another set of jobs going forward, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'd love to address the point that Chris just made about workers who will lose their jobs. Because that's one of the things we're working on now is something called the Just Transition. And it's recognizing the fact that even though there are a lot of green jobs being created, there are workers in the fossil fuel industries and the supporting industries who will lose their jobs. And how do you make those workers whole again? How do you make those communities that are fossil fuel dependent get behind the idea of doing something that's pro-clean energy and pro-climate? So we're looking at ways to fund early retirement, fund worker transition, retraining programs, and thinking about siting manufacturing plants in the communities that are hardest hit. And that is a very important component as we move toward a cleaner energy economy, is to recognize that there will be losses in places and to make sure we're addressing those.
All right, let's grab another call here. Eric from St. Paul, good morning. What do you have this morning?
Good morning. Good morning. My name's Eric. I work with a local renewable energy company called Innovative Power Systems. And kind of like Ryan earlier, we've seen kind of a massive shift in growth over the last year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say that some folks might not realize it, but community solar is one of the biggest growth engines in the industry, mm-hmm. and Minnesota has the largest program in the country currently. And so I don't know if your panel has any experience or wants to discuss that, but I thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah, thank you very much, Eric. Chris, I know community solar, we've got lots of projects coming online across the state. Where do we stand with that?
Well, it was interesting when I was doing the interview with the head of Green River Energy. I said, mm-hmm. well, what are you learning from other states in this area? And he said, well, actually, they're learning from us. So there's really a lot going on here in Minnesota. And this is to our earlier question, I believe it was from Nora, mm-hmm. where she's talking about rural areas.
Yes.
And you know, community solar is having a genuine impact in rural areas where you are getting cooperatives that see this as part of what they're doing in their community. So I think it's exciting. There's a lot farther needs to go. But when we're talking about rural Minnesota with cooperatives and a history of cooperatives and history of sort of community and community generation, I think this is a really intriguing area.
Interesting. Heidi, your perspective on anything Chris just said or from our caller, Eric?
Yeah, I do think community wind, community solar, community ownership of renewable energy is a really interesting model, and it's something to think about from an equity perspective, from the ownership not being in the hands of corporate electric utilities, but rather in the hands of the community who's benefiting and getting to make their own decisions around what energy sources they want to use.
Heidi, solar, I think I said now employs more than two times the coal industry, almost equal to natural gas. renewables jobs growing. What's the trajectory the next 5 to 10 years if things stay on the course they are?
There is room to create millions more jobs in wind and solar, some in geothermal energy, somewhat in bioenergy as well. And all of these jobs, as you mentioned, you know, there is greater employment in solar than in coal. And if you look at, you know, just the effect of spending $1 million or $1 billion in a renewable energy industry versus fossil fuels, the renewable energy industry is much more labor intensive. So a lot more of that spending goes toward hiring workers as opposed to spending on capital equipment. And so there is a much greater job creation potential for when we're spending on clean energy versus fossil fuels.
Chris, that's some interesting economics, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think this is where we come down to the public policy. And I know, you know, our consensus expectation, not much is going to happen on the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where, for in order to have continued job growth, you're going to need something like, you know, raising the carbon tax or have something that sort of becomes a game changer, that more and more investment money, because in a sense, what we'll then do is drop this whole category of green jobs. I mean, it will just simply be so many jobs will be tied into energy efficiency, alternative energy, making things more efficient. We'll just broaden that category. But and then it would accelerate some of the investments in terms of wind turbine and solar.
Great discussion. You know, I like to think of it this way, you guys. We didn't leave the Stone Age because we ran out of stones, right? We found a better way to do things. We used to burn wood and coal in our homes for heat, but there are better ways to produce energy as technology advances. So from my perspective, it'll be really interesting to see what our energy portfolio looks like in about 50 years. Chris Farrell and Heidi Garrett Pelletier from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, great discussion today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Coming up after the news, we're going to dig a little deeper into what's already happening in Minnesota with renewable jobs and energy efficiency. But first, here's Mike Moen with the news.
Good morning. The company building the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline has resumed construction on the final stretch of the $3.8 billion project. Energy Transfer Partners began work late yesterday after getting final permission from the Army Corps of Engineers to proceed with the crossing of the Missouri River in North Dakota. The work had been stalled for months due to opposition by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, but President Donald Trump last month instructed the Corps to advance pipeline construction. Meanwhile, one of two American Indian tribes fighting the pipeline has filed a legal challenge to try to block its completion. The Cheyenne River Sioux worries a pipeline leak could contaminate its drinking water. Developers say the pipeline is safe. This morning, President Trump's pick for U.S. Attorney General will be sworn in. Former Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama was confirmed by the Senate last night. Trump's choice for Health Secretary, Congressman Tom Price, could be confirmed today after Republicans yesterday voted to short-circuit delaying tactics. Nearly 1,700 flights have been canceled at New York City's three major airports because of a powerful winter storm hitting the region. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey says Newark International has the most cancellations, with more than 600. And stocks are opening modestly higher on Wall Street as investors found several bright spots in the latest batch of company earnings. Statewide forecast for the rest of today, it'll be sunny, highs ranging from 10 to 20 degrees. Some areas up north will be in the single digits. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's mostly sunny and 6 above zero. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:37.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, Somalia has elected a new president, and there's news today that a court has blocked the closing of the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. We'll have an update on both of those stories, and I'll visit with Dave Simonette, best known for work with Trampled by Turtles. He has a new solo album, and he'll perform some songs at 11.
Programming is supported by the McKnight Foundation, driving sustainable solutions to help the Midwest be a leader in advancing a clean energy economy. Online at McKnight.org.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing. Together with Mike Rowe, Benjamin Franklin Plumbing supports skilled plumbers who have the tools and expertise to get the job done right the first time. Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, the punctual plumbers. 877-BEN-1776.
Welcome back, everybody, to this one-hour special edition of ClimateCast. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Today, we're talking about climate change and jobs. Specifically, how is the clean energy revolution unfolding and generating jobs? And what does the future look like as clean energy economy unfolds in the next 10 to 50 years? I want to hear your thoughts on the idea of a renewable energy revolution. Do you support renewables? What's your take on growing numbers for clean energy jobs that we're seeing? And what ideas do you have for a clean energy revolution? To talk about what's happening here in Minnesota, we have Jay Drake Hamilton, the Science Policy Director at Fresh Energy. Good morning, Jay.
Hello, Paul. Great to be on.
Great to talk to you again. And Patrick Hamilton, Director of Global Change Initiatives at the Science Museum of Minnesota. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Paul.
And Chris Farrell sticks with us for the next half hour here, so thanks for that. Jay, I want to start with you and right here in Minnesota. Where does Minnesota stand right now in terms of clean energy jobs? How many jobs are there, and how fast are we adding jobs?
This is a great news story, and people should know this, that Minnesota had an early start and has had continued policy support for clean energy, and it's given us a real competitive advantage. I was just looking at a study that the Brookings Institute came out with this winter that showed that 33 states, including Minnesota, have now decoupled their economy. Economic growth is happening while carbon reductions are also happening. So well, in Minnesota, our gross state product between 2000 and 2014 increased 23%, and carbon went down almost 4%. And the result in Minnesota, we're now 10 years into these policies in Minnesota, and it's reducing our state's dependence on imported energy. And the average annual wage in the 15,000 clean energy jobs we have had, we've grown in Minnesota since 2000, is the average annual wage is $71,000 a year. So that's 42% higher, for context, than the statewide average for all jobs. And if you look across the categories of clean energy jobs, those workers have in 2013 earned more than $1 billion in wages. So if you're a leader interested in a shot in the arm for the economy, clean energy jobs are a great way to do that.
And I assume that's not just Minnesota, Jay. What about Wisconsin? What about the other states near us in the upper Midwest?
Yeah, the Midwest is realizing that we have a wealth of solar, wind, and energy efficiency resources, technology deployment, and real sense of innovation on the part of entrepreneurs. And we're developing jobs around that.
Jay, what's the balance of power generation right now in Minnesota, and how much has it changed over the last 10 to 20 years if we talk about the percentage of renewables versus coal and gas?
This is a real success story for policy, and Minnesotans should know this. So if we look at a snapshot of 2004 to 2014, so just a 10-year period, we went from electricity coming about two-thirds from coal in 2004, and today that's down to a little less than 50% coal. And what's taken up, made the difference and diversified our electricity portfolio is the growth of wind and now solar energy. And so we have a much more diverse mix of power sources, a lot more of them local, and it has contributed to those jobs. If you look around the state of Minnesota, and if you look at the supply chain for those jobs in solar and wind, we have 82 companies in Minnesota that are in the solar business and 49 companies in the wind business, and an additional 16 companies that do both solar and wind. My favorite story is out of the Avon Hills in Minnesota, central Minnesota. Yep. There's a 110-year-old company called Blattner Energy that diversified first from construction. They built on their construction business. They testified in the legislature about this last week and said, we diversified and we first grew into wind and now solar. And every Minnesotan should know that one-third of all the wind farms in this country were built by Blattner Energy out of central Minnesota.
Interesting. Chris, what do you think of these numbers as you look across Minnesota?
I think these numbers are exciting, and I also think it provides a real opportunity for Minnesota and other states, because one of the things when you talk to these companies, they do have growth. They're all complaining about a lack of qualified workers. And I think this is a real opportunity for policymakers to be saying, okay, we have segments of our population that are underemployed. We have parts of our population that are not doing that well economically. Right. And yet we have this growing sector. And it's not just in the green jobs or other growing sectors of our economy. You know, how do we take advantage of this constant complaint. Cannot find these qualified workers. Where are these qualified workers? And so I just want to add that there is a real opportunity here to increase the skill level of the population here in Minnesota.
Sounds like a great addition to the technical colleges across Minnesota, some of the programs.
Absolutely.
Pat Hamilton, we've talked about the project you've been shepherding at the Science Museum of Minnesota with your energy efficiency retrofit. Can you give us an update on where that stands now?
Sure, Paul. I'm actually looking at a screenshot from just yesterday morning. It was cold yesterday. It was 4 degrees above zero, and 100% of the heating needs of the Science Museum were being supplied by waste heat energy that 2 years ago we were throwing away.
Wow. And I assume that's happening on more days. Give us an overall big picture of how much energy one building, one big building in downtown St. Paul, the Science Museum, is saving after you've completed this energy retrofit.
We have cut the heating load of the Science Museum by 75%. And that is year-round, though the equipment that we're using called heat recovery chillers are basically run from November through April. So almost all of the heating load of the Science Museum in the wintertime is being supplied by heat energy being generated internally within the museum that previously we were expelling from the building. And now with these machines, we capture that heat energy where it's being generated within the building in excess and moving it to where we need it.
And I can hear some of our audience members thinking, well, that sounds really great, but how much did it cost, and what's the payback on that investment?
Sure, it costs money to save money, and we spent $900,000 on the retrofit, and we're saving around $300,000 a year, so it's a payback of 3 years.
That's pretty amazing. And what about the kind of jobs that were used to complete that retrofit? How many jobs were there, and what types of jobs were they?
Sure. So the heat recovery chillers were manufactured down in La Crosse, so we helped employ factory workers. And then the truckers who delivered them from La Crosse to St. Paul, and then the riggers that lifted them off the trucks and maneuvered them into position, and the concrete workers who poured the pads that the machines sit on. And then from there, pipe fitters, electricians, sheet metal workers, you know, a whole raft of skilled tradespeople that worked on just this one building over the span of about 18 months.
So that's one building, Jay. How do we extrapolate that number of jobs if we were to do that sort of energy efficiency retrofit to most of America's big buildings?
Well, you know, it begins to look almost limitless. About 40% of the energy that's used in this country is used in buildings. And if you think about extrapolating from the Science Museum, an existing but pretty new building, to all of the existing buildings in Minnesota and across the land, you see an enormous way for everyone to save lots of money on energy, cut waste, which I think everyone supports, and really employ a lot of people across a large number of skilled trades. And a lot of these are union jobs as well. And these are jobs that happen. These are retrofits that can happen in buildings while business is going on in the building. So you're not interrupting business. You're able to do both things at once.
Chris Farrell, this sounds pretty good. How does it look to you from an economic standpoint?
So I, 2 points. One, I just want I think one of the things that's really exciting about this conversation that you sparked here is so much of the conversation when you're thinking about alternative energy or water, for example, which really brings global climate change at home for a lot of people. And it's always about this sort of the cost of it. Mm-hmm. And yet if you think about it, just here in Minnesota, if you add Ecolab and Pentair and all the small water companies, and then what's been this whole discussion about the small and growing solar companies and wind, that there's also a lot of economic growth and a lot of brain power that's going on there. However, I do want to say that it's a dynamic economy. People do lose their jobs. Things become more efficient. The job growth does slow down as people become more productive in how they do it. A lot of the job growth is that people are still trying to figure it out. So you hire another body, and you get it kind of figured out. You get rid of those bodies because you don't need them the same way.
Sure.
Again, it's exciting. Mm-hmm. It's the future. It's the way we need to go. But I would just be a little bit modest in the job projections.
And tempered.
Well, Paul
on
and Chris, I'd love to comment
Go
on
ahead,
that transition.
Please.
Because Chris is right, it's really important. And I want to drill down on what I think Heidi said earlier, that today in the United States, and most people don't know this, today in the United States, there are four times as many jobs in solar and wind than in the coal industry. And the coal industry has been losing jobs mostly to automation for the last 50 years or so. So we're already in that transition. Mm-hmm. In fact, the CEO of Xcel Energy here in Minnesota, I think he has a great term for this, a great phrase. He says when they invest in wind power, they're substituting steel for fuel. And, of course, there are American workers who are mining the components of that steel, forging that steel, delivering that steel, and other workers who are installing that steel. So I think we can have a richer conversation now that the economics have changed utterly in clean energy about how we get more clean energy jobs, who gets those jobs, how we train people for those jobs. And what we're finding in rural Minnesota, there was a question earlier, is that we have a lot of wind farms in rural Minnesota, mm-hmm. and they are bringing property tax advantages to those counties. They're helping to pay for schools and roads and libraries, which is great. And many of them are actually employing local young people who've grown up in those communities, gotten trained, and are running multi-million dollar wind farms and thus being able to stay in their local communities and raise their families there. So that's a great success story.
And, well, one question, too. These jobs, they're not easily outsourceable, are they?
Yeah, they're really local jobs. Mm-hmm. And when you think about improving our homes and improving our businesses to make them more energy efficient, ultimately we have to make the types of changes the Science Museum has made. We need to make them on all the buildings. And that's an exciting job growth engine. And it's something that should be happening with local labor. And we definitely have the skill set in Minnesota and the Midwest to make sure that that happens.
We're talking about clean energy and jobs and climate change on ClimateCast today. Kathy in Minneapolis, let's go to the phones. Good morning. What is your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and it's a great connection to my point as well. It's not just only about the construction jobs of, you know, making the turbines or the solar panels. Mm-hmm. We really need to, we're already seeing much more beyond that, and I'll give two examples. A friend of mine, Jeremy Kalin, started a company maybe 12 years ago. He deals exclusively with the financial services part of this. So he has investors that provide the money and small or medium-sized businesses that want to install the mainly solar panels but don't have the money to do that because it's very expensive equipment. So he connects those and provides all the financial ratings and everything, and his company has grown tremendously. And the other example is all the related areas of the survey crews that have to go out and mark the locations, or the people that do the title searches like I did.
Mm-hmm.
This has been just a huge expansion of those related jobs. And as well as you mentioned, the people, once the installation is done and up and running, the people that actually run the thing, which is, you know, ad infinitum, that there is also really skilled jobs there too. So think beyond just the hard hat jobs to all the other related things. And, you know, it's a huge thing. My question is, are these other jobs counted in the job growth for the renewable energy sector?
Okay, great question. Chris Farrell, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, at the studies that I've looked at that have been pretty careful trying to look at what are the spillover effects, they do include mm-hmm. them. So if you think about wind, there's a group in St. Paul that does wind forecasting around mm-hmm. the nation. And this
right.
is a business that has really grown up.
Yeah.
And so, yes, a lot of these careful studies do try and capture that. Some of them are just looking straightforward at installation, what's happening in solar, what's happening in wind. But no, most of them try and capture some of that.
Let's take another call. Sarah from St. Paul. Good morning. What's your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate a lot of what Jay actually just mentioned about some of the benefits in rural areas. We have communities that are very reliant upon a not-so-certain agricultural market. And when these wind farms move in there, the economic boom that they feel and are sustained with completely changes that community. And I think we can get a little Twin Cities focused sometimes, but this is revitalizing some of the agricultural communities that just don't have a lot of other options. And we're able to then export that power from Minnesota and use it as a resource in other states for private industry as well as our own utilities here in the state. So I just wanted to bring that up again, because this really is something that isn't just happening in the urban areas, but it's really impacting rural Minnesota right now.
All right, Sarah, thank you so much. Great comment. Let's keep it rolling from greater Minnesota. Dan from Rochester, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to call and give a Rochester perspective here. You know, we're going through a huge residential building boom, and the Destination Medical Center is getting rolling here. Lots of state investment, lots of private investment, and there's a real opportunity here for renewables, for energy-efficient buildings, and we've got a mayor who certainly wants to make our city carbon neutral by 2030, mm-hmm. and just some really great goals, and certainly just to kind of dovetail off your last few callers, you know, we're a rural county, Olmsted County, Dodge County. There's certainly lots of opportunities here to partner in our tri-county area to get power to the Destination Medical Center and to Rochester, which is set to boom here in the next 20, 30 years. So I just wanted to, give a greater Minnesota perspective on this. And Rochester's full of people who believe in technology and believe in research, and I think we'd be a great place for the state to focus some of these renewable energy resources if the legislature doesn't nip them in the bud.
All right, Dan, thank you. Great comment. And, you know, interesting, you drive down I-35 South, you can see the wind farms everywhere. In fact, you can see them on Doppler radar some mornings. There's this phenomenon called super refraction where if there's temperature inversions, the radar beam bends and you can see these stationary objects, and they're wind turbines in southern Minnesota. Pat Hamilton, I wanted to touch base on one angle here with you. I know you've worked with the local power provider there in your upgrade. What's the incentive for power companies to be moving toward renewables? Why are they doing it?
Well, I think that the Advanced Heat Recovery Project that we did, we're kind of unique because we're part of a district heating and cooling system, mm-hmm. and District Energy St. Paul was very supportive in us doing this retrofit. But the great majority of buildings in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota are freestanding, have their own heating and cooling systems. And so I think in particular what the Science Museum has done and has been done in a few other manufacturing facilities in Minnesota demonstrates a tremendous ability for buildings to substantially reduce their energy consumption. Jay mentioned buildings using 40% of all energy in the United States, mm-hmm. and commercial institutional industrial buildings, given their size and scale, use a tremendous amount of energy. And I think what we're showing at the Science Museum is that the technology exists right now, right today, to dramatically reduce the energy consumption of our large commercial buildings in ways that are cost-effective.
Jay, I want to hit back on that real quickly with you in terms of the power utilities. They're adopting a much greater share as renewables. I know some of that is legislation, but what is there an economic incentive there? Quickly, we're getting a little tight on time for power utilities to adopt more renewables.
Yeah, state policy is still very important, and we need to keep that in place. But as well, the market economics have changed. So Xcel Energy, for example, and the other utilities are finding over the last 2 years that wind energy has routinely been cheaper when they go out for bid than natural gas. So isn't that great? Renewable energy cheaper than fossil fuel? And solar is coming on very rapidly. The National Renewable Energy Lab thinks that in 2020, solar will cost between 3 and 4 cents a kilowatt hour. To put that into perspective, I pay on my home energy bill about 11 cents a kilowatt hour today. And so that means that we can have a much deeper discussion about how to move faster. You know, we're just at the tip of the iceberg on this clean energy jobs economy. Because of the climate change that you talk about every week, Paul, and on ClimateCast, and our need to address it, we're going to need to scale this up rapidly to get to where we need to be, and that's going to mean even more jobs across the Midwest and across this country.
All right, you guys, what a discussion today. Very lively. We covered a lot of territory. I want to thank you for that. And the phone lines are lit up, I can tell you that. So thanks for the calls that got through. For those of you that didn't, we'll do it again. J. Drake Hamilton, Science Policy Director at Fresh Energy, thank you. Patrick Hamilton, Director of Global Change Initiatives at the Science Museum of Minnesota, thank you. And Chris Farrell, Economics Guru for all things NPR, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, as we go out today, I'm thinking about something that happened 60 years ago. The year was 1957, and 67 countries joined to explore science in what was called the International Geophysical Year, or IGY. The IGY focused on 11 Earth sciences, including meteorology, oceanography, and solar activity. Both the Soviet Union and the U.S. launched artificial satellites for this event, and the space age was born. Today, 60 years later, we're on the verge of another revolution of sorts. We're changing the way we use energy here on planet Earth. So today we go out with Donald Fagen's tribute to that International Geophysical Year 60 years ago. It's IGY. That's it for ClimateCast this week. I'm Paul Huttner. Thanks for listening.